I'm going to talk today about a relatively new, very new for public health, but relatively new in the semantic world, a set of technologies that we're finding very useful in managing information in public health. I want to get a little bit of a background. I know a lot of people out here, but so how many people are familiar with the semantic web languages, with RDF and OWL and others? Okay. And how many people here are very familiar with relational database technology? Okay, so I think that pretty much sums it up about where we are. So a lot of people have, in our community, have said, well, you know, really, what we're seeing in the semantic web technologies, to an extent, are really what we saw when we moved from hierarchical databases to relational databases, where it's still a way to manage information. And there really isn't anything particularly magical about any of these technologies. They all work together and have to work together to build the complete solutions. And we'll go through that more at the end of the talk. So please, we want to keep this fairly informal. It's meant to be, quote, a workshop. So feel free to interrupt any time, and we'll leave plenty of room at the end, hopefully, for some questions. So if you want to get a little more detail or you don't understand anything that I'm saying, then that would be usual. And stop me and ask the questions.
You might talk about the Thursday session.
Ah, that's right. Thursday, we actually have an extended version of this where we'll get into actually some application demos of how these ontologies work together and feed applications and go a bit deeper into the public health ontology that we built so that people can kind of see how the HL7 version 3 standard works together with ontologies to give us an edge on some reasoning problems. So first of all, I want to say we've as GB has said, we do a lot of work here at the CDC, but this all views expressed in this talk are our views and not meant to represent any CDC or any other government agency views. So what is an ontology? That's kind of the first basic, because I hear the word ontology everywhere I go, and when I then talk to people, I'm not sure that they're talking about the same thing that I'm talking about. So there are a few definitions of what an ontology is, and from you know, if you talk to Barry Smith, you're going to get another view of this compared to talking to some of the other people in the semantic world, like John Sowell and some others. So Barry's philosophy is the study of the nature of being, existence, or reality, whoever's reality we're talking about, in general, of its basic categories and their relations, with particular emphasis on determining what entities exist or can be said to exist and how these can be grouped and related. So kind of keep that in mind, because there are somewhat subtle differences as we go through this. So that's the philosophical. They're describing the world of being, of existence. If you look at the more computer science information side of ontologies, an ontology is a formal representation of a set of concepts within a domain and the relationship between those concepts. And this is in from the Wikipedia. It's actually John Gruber's definition, Tom Gruber's definition of it. And when you think about the way we think about ontologies in the standards world representation, this is our definition, which has been adopted by a few others, including the OMG, is the semantic definition, is the declarative definition of a universe of discourse that models the entities and the relationships that hold among them. And the last part is utilizing a formalized structure which incorporates standardized terminology. And we're seeing this more and more as people really start to get into the semantics of this, that while you can do a lot of semantic work with OWL and with RDF, it's really that coded representation of the values there that give you the edge on the semantic interoperability. And so we think that's part of the ontology definition extension. So to say what something is usually not enough. You also have to say what it is not. And this will become more important as we talk about the OWL language, because it has an open-world assumption. So it's never enough to say what something is. You must also say what it is not, because if you don't do that, everything can be that. So what is not an ontology? And these are some of the things that I hear people referring to as ontologies, or a thesaurus. A thesaurus is just a dictionary, but instead of the definitions and pronunciation, it usually contains synonyms and antonyms and relationships to a particular concept to further characterize the concept. And folksonomy, how many have heard of that term at all? Okay. And folksonomy is real popular right now on Web 2.0. Delicious tags and other kinds of social networking tags to do collaborative interpretation of data and to kind of organize information around a consensus. And that's really what folksonomy is all about. And there's the idea that when you start to manage these tags and you to annotate knowledge, that eventually the community of human beings will kind of come together to eventually refine that definition using folksonomy to make it more formalized over time. But right now it's a fairly informal representation of the relationships of knowledge to how we think about that knowledge. Taxonomies are something that Jim Case could tell us all about. It typically used in the world of organisms, and in fact if you look up the definition, it pertains to organisms. And it's the practice and science of classification of taxonomic units, which are organisms that are arranged frequently in a hierarchical structure. Now, we use the term taxonomy for a lot of things. And you know, Boeing has a taxonomy of airplane parts and engine parts and other things. Mind maps are really diagrams. If you sit down and, you know, I always think about the psychiatry movies where they sit down, give me the first thing that you think about that comes out of your mind. Well, that's a lot of what we do when we think about anything. Is we think about a thought, and another thought is derived from that thought, and another one is that, and pretty soon, you know, 5 minutes later, we're not thinking about the same thing we were thinking about originally. We're thinking about something else, but you could actually walk those connections back to the first thing we thought of. And that's really what a mind map does. It's a diagram that represents those words, ideas, and the terms linked, arranged radially around something you thought about at the beginning of it. A topic map is another W3C standard, the World Wide Web Consortium. And topic maps are somewhat like super refinements of XML schemas, and somewhat like RDF, and a little bit like OWL, but is none of those things, in that it is expressed in XML, but does not have formalisms for a wide range of connecting elements or sets of elements together like OWL does, because its specific role is in defining literature or topics related to something. So it represents information using topics, associations that link those topics, and then an occurrence is representing essentially instances of the information resources that look for that. So if you think about it in library science, if we were going to use topic maps, we would use them to categorize all of the web pages at the CDC and link it to topics of particular interest, and it would be, and that's a common use for this, is really looking at organizing very large bits of information linking together. And then a concept map is really, it's a diagram that was developed by a man, Novak from Chicago, University of Chicago, back in the early 70s in the educational world, thinking that it was more the way people thought in concepts, and then you link these concepts together, something like mind maps, except it doesn't come from radially, it has a very complex representation that allows relationships and recursive relationships and other things. And it's a diagram that shows those concepts and relationships among them. There's actually something we'll get into a little bit later, you'll also see this as an example of one of the editors for ontologies. And that's a subset of concept maps. So this is an example of a taxonomy, and in this case, I'm kind of showing that, well, you can construct a taxonomy of things other than organisms. We have a taxonomy of diseases that comes from SNOMED. This is represented in an ontology. It's still a taxonomy, that portion of it. This is kind of what we're talking about by mind maps that kind of start from a central theme and then radiate out your ideas and branches out from that. This is the typical structure of a topic map. As I say, this is a W3C standard, so it has tooling behind it and formal ways to represent that. This is a concept map, and this is a kind of a case definition concept map. So this is while this talk isn't really about public health, it's about ontology engineering. This, again, gives you an idea of how you use that in public health to link your concepts together. And the things that you can't do, and the difference between concept maps, as we said, and mind maps, you couldn't have that has intertest interval related to those things in a mind map. And this is an ontology. And this is a simple ontology, and I tried to put one from our public health ontology, but they're too complex. It just shows our public health domain is a bit more complex. But this is looking at essentially the elements ontology and looking at states of elements being gas or solids or liquids, and some of the definitions, the instantiated definitions of subclass of and RDF rest and first and other things that give a formal representation of how concepts can relate to each other. So if you have all these ontologies, and there are a lot of ontologies out there right now, so one of the things that I didn't put, that I should have put in here as a reference is if you think about the BioPortal, which is an ontology resource center, a National Center for Biomedical Ontologies, where you can go query, download all sorts of ontologies, gene ontology and or pointers to the gene ontology. You can download the disease ontology, which is kind of a high-level rough draft of diseases, the taxonomy of diseases, but lots of different ontologies, more all the time. So if you want to get into learning about ontologies, one of the best ways to do that is to go and explore ontologies that already exist and see how people have built them. The nice thing about NCBIO, they're developing a framework for evaluating ontologies as well. So how well does this ontology describe the domain it's meant to describe? How complete is it? How sound are its relationships and so on? So it's something that's a nice thing to have for us in the ontology world. So you can use an ontology for just about anything, but the places to really use it are things that make our lives easier as humans to organize and reason about our information. So it's very nice to organize information for a human to recall, especially when the amount of data that you get is too difficult for a human to catalog in their mind and even know where to get it. So an example of that, a real ontology out there in the world, is NASA's ontology of the Mars images. So they have these constantly feeding back. How could they ever possibly keep track and relationships to which image was of this rock when there are so many rocks? So, you know, what they need an ontology to kind of track that thing, and they use actually protege ontologies to organize their concept maps of and relationships of images there. Other places that they're used for information that's a bit too complicated to keep in your mind. Mercedes-Benz uses it to build cars. Boeing uses them to build your airplanes. So there are lots of uses out there in the non-medical world. And in fact, they were using some of the big names in ontologies work for Boeing, and they work for Shell Oil, and they work for things. I've learned things from these guys I never knew about, like how they get absolutely the most money out of us for oil. It is all done with ontology engineering. So it's used to standardize a domain so that we're all talking about exactly the same thing. So if you have representations in a formal structure, then it's very difficult to say something to where we can't understand it, because you can always reference back to the way it's represented in that domain. They can be used to drive software, and we'll demonstrate that live on Thursday. You can drive value sets for menus, because the organization of the ontologies, if it's organized such that you have a relationship between these causative organisms and this disease, then you have a value set of causative organisms for this disease, and those can be exported from the ontology. to educate someone, to provide middleware for mapping between systems, and I can tell you some little work we're doing for the NCI for that. Workflow, this is particularly something we're looking at for defining web services interfaces. So if you have an ontology, if you're a user and you want to come to a site currently right now, you find a UDDI registry that tells you where that web service is, you go to the web service, that service may or may not provide the functionality you want. But if we have an ontology that knows the registered users for our application are allowed access to that API, then one of the things we can do is feed up the API that we know that that person needs so that you have a dynamic services interface that that is always ready to take care of the needs of that person. So we're exploring a little bit of that at the NCI now. Middleware for mapping is another one where if you have a heterogeneous, if you have a database and you want to now conform to some other standard requirement, so I've got to work with CA Big and I've got to go from some non-compliant application and make a compliant output, one nice way to do it is structure all of your information in your ontology that maps these things together so that your output, and tell it what kind of output you need for this particular instance and send it that way. You can use it as a search application. So Google is probably somebody you've heard of, Yahoo. So they use a lot of ontologies at Google and Yahoo to help find information. Classification of data, and we'll give you an example of that for case classifications of infectious diseases, but you can classify lots of information that way. And then, of course, reasoning against data and some extensions that you need to reason that are usually part of the ontology editing tools and in some cases are external reasoning agents. So what about this whole group here that knows about databases but doesn't know about ontologies, and when do you use one and what do you need to use it for? Kind of the first thing you have to realize is that the high-level difference between a database and an ontology in the OWL or RDF family is that databases are closed worlds. You always know exactly what's in your database because unless you have a column and and some attribute that tells you that's what it is, you can't stick it in your database. You know, you can create tables, but you still have to make those attributes to do it. In ontologies, they're really open world. So, as I said before, unless you say something isn't something, you know, unless I say that this piece of paper is not a microorganism, in the ontology, it may classify it as a microorganism if it has some properties that are similar to it, that it exists in space and it is yellow in color, and that's all you said about it, then it doesn't know that it's not something else that shares a property of something that's yellow and occupies space. And that's one of the strengths as well as one of the weaknesses, and I use that weakness relatively. So databases, obviously you organize data for queries and you can mine your data for known attributes. You cannot make new associations automatically. It has very basic knowledge of semantics described only by its relationship through foreign keys to other tables. So that's as much as you know about the data in your database from a semantic perspective. Ontologies support this logical inferencing and reasoning, which takes care of this, cannot make new associations, because it can make new associations. It can say things that you didn't tell it to begin with. So it can't. It's not just returning what it knows that you put in there, but it's also returning new knowledge to you. It makes the semantics of data structures explicit, so that I can say this is a subclass of this, and the language allows me to reason against that, and always classify that way. And it's application independent. So have you ever built a database that's just a database out there? Well, it's always got some purpose that you know about that it's going to be used to feed some application. You created it for use. But somebody might organize an ontology just because they think this is a nice ontology and someone might use it. And that's exactly what you can do because it's agnostic about the application that it goes into. Doesn't really care. So there are some basic ontology languages, and there are many more than this, but we're constrained to talk to this because we could be talking for the next week. But the common ones, and certainly the ones that we use or are planning to use, we heavily use OKBC frames because it allows you to do some of the complexity that we experience in public health and in HL7 version 3 that cannot be accurately represented in OWL. We use RDF because it's nice to have the triples where we can merge data between them. So since RDF is self-describing, it can describe itself to another file so that the two files can be merged together seamlessly. And this is a really strong point of it, and it's kind of one of the real vision that Tim Berners-Lee had for the semantic web, and it's the principal reason for doing that. RDFS adds some complexity to RDF and lets you describe certain things like the domain of discourse that you're talking about and the range of attributes, things that can answer the question for that domain. And then the OWL family, the ontology web language file. And by the way, RDF stands for Resource Description Framework, because everything in RDF is a resource. These are all W3C languages. OWL comes in kind of three varieties. So when we talk about the ontology web language, we are usually, most people are talking about the description logic one. So that's actually kind of the middle part of the family, and each of these has its own use. So OWL Lite adds a little more complexity to RDFS. It uses RDFS data types and constraints. It just adds to it to start to be able to work with true set theory. So if you think about, if you put a dividing line between RDFS and OWL, really you're talking about the stopping with schema definitions and starting with mathematical definitions. And that's kind of the cutoff point. OWL uses formal set mathematical set theory to define all of its relationships. Now, OWL Lite, as I said, adds just a few more attributes, and we'll go through those on compared to RDFS. DL adds the ability to do subsumption testing, description logic for it. And OWL Full gives you some of the flexibility you have in frames, still using the OWL XML syntax. So you can describe meta classes in OWL Full that you are not allowed to do in DL or OWL Lite. That comes with a price, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we go forward. And you have to ask yourself if you would ever really want to have an OWL Full ontology. There's some reasons why you might not in our space. And then Common Logic was approved in November by the W3C and is meant to be a translation layer that will allow us to work with any of these and translate between all of them in addition to some other languages. And it has some really cool things, some expressions in natural language that allow you to hook any natural language center into its composite parts and then translate it to DL or other things. And they have made Common Logic available for free, so you can actually, the specification went to free status in January, so you're able to download that without paying anything for it. I would encourage you to look at that because I think that is the future. No one is using Common, there are no tools for Common Logic yet, and no one is using it unless you want to handcraft a bunch of stuff. There's a company called VivoMind, which is John So and some others, his partners from IBM own that, and they're coming up with some tools, which I think all of us are really looking forward to. So we'll go through a little bit more about when to use these things a little later on. As you learn more about the properties, I think some of it will be evident to you about when to use them. So frames, it's kind of one of the earlier views, not as early as OIL, but followed on OIL. We didn't talk about OIL and DAML that came out of DARPA projects, and frames was actually developed with DARPA money as well through Stanford. And the group, the Knowledge Discovery Group at Stanford, developed this. The Medical Informatics Group wrote the Protégé Editor. So those two groups are actually slightly different. So the specification came from one, tool came from the other. Everything in a OKBC, an open knowledge-based connectivity ontology, is a frame. And So slots are frames, and facets are frames, and classes and instances, everything is a frame. So it's kind of its basic unit of representation. And then the others add specific attributes to those frames. They describe the frames. So a slot represents the attributes that would define the connections, the relationship between concepts. Facets refine those slots so that you can give additional meaning to a particular slot value. A class is an abstract concept which may have instances, real world instances. So when I talk about anthrax, Bacillus anthrax, I'm not really talking about that organism that was picked up on that culture in the post office, usually. You know, I'm talking about the class of Bacillus anthracis. And if I want to talk about an instance, then I might talk about that organism or that two organisms that were identified on some BioWatch filter somewhere. Metaclasses are ways to organize classes into a collection. And it's a very powerful thing when we're talking about constructs like HL7 version 3 and persisting that model. And so if you say, well, why would we want to do that? Because the whole point of HL7 version 3 was to provide semantics. So if you want to enhance the semantics of your ontology language, you can do it with another semantic data model expressed in your semantic language that gives you added semantics. And that's why we use the metaclasses, and that's why the public health ontology is in the frames language for that reason. So, but you may not always want to keep it in frames. So, and we don't. So we export to RDF triple so we can do some other fun stuff with it. So RDF, as I said before, is the resource description framework. And everything in the resource description framework is a triple. And a triple is this that we're talking about here. You know, and this is the example. So a triple is a subject, which is either an RDF URI, so a universal resource indicator, so like a URL would be one type of a URI, or it could be a blank node. And blank nodes are kind of things like the abstract things, an address, but not actually a particular address. So that's what we would call a blank node in an ontology, because it points to other things that instantiate that blank node. It's kind of a way of getting classes and instances in RDF. The predicate, which is the connection between your subject and your object, and the object, which is, as we always learned in English grammar, is what you're talking about. So in this example, so we have this web page that had some, so the web page being our subject, and the creator of that, which is our predicate, and the object of that predicate is John Smith. Okay, in our world, it's, you know, Bacillus anthracis would be our subject, and causes would be our predicate, and the object would be inhalation anthrax. So if you think about triples and how you would use it, that's a triple statement, and organizing those triple statements is what you do with RDF. So how do we organize it? So this is a graphical representation that shows you how you organize those. Because if you think about how RDF triples are stored in the database, it's just a list of terms. It's a single table with just stacks of RDF triples in it. So how do we make sense of that? Well, we make sense of it by figuring out what other triples that triple refers to and how they get related. So RDF allows these type definitions that allow us to say the type of this thing is creator. And it lets us do property definitions that say that our properties that we're referring to are going to be, in some cases, these particular nodes. And it lets us do things that can map to a URI, or it lets us to do literals. And so, well, actually both of these are literals, but we could map to a website for this guy. So when we're doing that, it gives you quite a bit of flexibility to talk about a lot of things in the world. It lets us talk about simple relationships between things. It lets us organize those relationships together by going from one to another, and it lets us have things that we can find by URI and things that we can't, that we know are literals. So that's essentially what RDF can do for us. And that's actually pretty powerful, because now we can use, we can do RSS news feeds using RDF triples, because that's what they do. That's what, this is what you get when you do an RSS news feed. And if we looked at it in the XML expression of that nodal group, this is, you know, kind of what we look at. And this is the RDF XML, but there are also some other simple, because this starts to get fairly heavyweight. You can imagine if you're talking about a lot of things and you're sending this across the wire, it gets pretty heavyweight. So there are actually some other very terse notations of that for expression in very simple XML terms that decrease the weight of the message as it's going across. So we find some usefulness of RDF, but some of the things you couldn't do with RDF. For instance, we can build a taxonomy, and we can define some properties that say this is a subclass of this thing, but that subclass term has no base definition in RDF. It's just another concept. It's no different than saying has a car. You know, it doesn't know how to interpret that. When we move to RDF schema, RDF schema starts to define some of these things in the standard that says, okay, so tools that now work with RDF schema have a very strict definition for what a subclass of something is. So if you say something is a subclass of something else, that's your triple, and you stick that anywhere in your ontology, it knows, no matter where it is, that it belongs to this other triple up here. So that's very powerful. So now I can do things like maintain taxonomies that I define for vocabularies in RDF, and no matter how I scramble or accidentally move something over somewhere or break up my file or split the file and send it off somewhere else to two places, I can now merge that back in exactly as it was represented initially, because I know what those relationships are and they're maintained in the schema. So this is the power of RDF schema, is to merge information from different places that has different namespaces into the same common thing defined by these subclasses. It also lets you define the domain and the range, which we don't have that in simple RDF, so that we can say this is the domain, this domain of diseases is related to the range of organisms that cause the diseases when they're expressed with that causal relationship. And it adds basic set operators, union and intersection. Okay, so you can say this RDF representation is the union of these groups of triples, or it's the intersection of these groups of triples. So some fairly simple representations for that. RDFS classes, so this is just straight from the W3C specification, are resources, classes. We talked about literals like age and name of someone as a literal expression. Some basic data types, which it inherits from the XML data types, adds a couple of it to it, uses the XML literal data type for that, and properties that we talked about. Range and domain and schema, subproperties and subclasses of. So since, remember that anything is a resource, all things are resources in RDF, so there's not really a lot of distinction between the relationships and the objects and the subjects that are hooked with that predicate. So the predicate can have subproperties as well. So you can have a has cause, and then you can have a subproperty of that has cause that might be has definitive cause or has, you know, some other relationship to it. And then we can talk about the containers and collections that you see in RDFS. So it has some basic containers that we use in, those of you from HL7 know about bags and sets and sequences that you can put together. So it's essentially how you organize those things in your collection, whether it's a strict list in a certain order or whether it's a random collection that you can pick something out of the bag like a marble. It lets you have an alternate for it. It lets you define that some object has membership in some container through some property. And then it lets you have within your collections the list to say what's first and what's the rest and what is a null value, so, or is not part of something. So that's where you can start to now constrain some of RDF to start building a little bit of reasoning with it, some basic taxonomic type of reasoning. So if we go to the Al White schema, then we see some of the same things there, and there's no reason, since we're all describing all of this in RDF, the Al is just another description and extension of RDF. So as you know, we inherit some of these properties from the RDFS language, the RDFS schema, to put into Al White, and in fact the whole Al family of things. So we have RDF property, RDF subclass of, and other things, which gives us the ability now to take RDF files and then bring them into our Al files, because we know how to relate it internally for that. It adds this concept, let me just go back up just real quick, of individuals. So we know how to define a class and we know how to define an individual. And remember, we didn't have that distinction in RDF straight. We had just the objects, and essentially everything is a class of something. And we have these equality and inequality. So we can say it's the same as this. So I can say that Jim Case is the same person as James Case. It lets us say, and that's through same individual as, different individuals from, so it starts letting us say that that individual is not this individual. So James Case, who is at UC Davis, is not the same James Case who is at some other institution. We're talking about two different people there, even with the same names. And then it follows the RDF core for its data types. It also adds these other pieces that we can start doing a little reason. So we can say that something is the inverse of something else. So it's the opposite of that. So it lets us start saying things like, a parent is the inverse of a child, so on. It lets us have transitive properties so that we know that children belong to their parents and that parents belong to their parents, and that if this child is related to this parent, then it must also be related to its grandparent, to that person's parent. It gives us functional properties that lets us now say things like, well, we've put this object into the ontology, and it is the only object like that that can be defined for this particular class. So it says, if I have a class of, this is not always true, so give me some leeway here, Jim. And so if I have an organism, I can say that its functional property might be its Gram staining. So it can only have one kind of Gram stain. And there are exceptions, obviously, for that. But I don't have a better thought right in my mind right now. So, and inverse functional properties that say this can have lots of different things associated with it. So as I said before, you're asking, well, why do I have to have all these things? Either I say it's inverse or I don't say anything about it. But Al doesn't allow that. You must say something about it if you want to classify things. Everything has to be strictly defined. And this is where the complexity of working with Al comes, is because if you forget one of these things, then your reasoning that you do with your ontology is not accurate. All values from lets us say that it, by definition, must consume each and every one of the things from the set that you have defined for these things, which is different than some values of, which says that some values mean that I'm taking something out of there, but not necessarily all, although I can take all if I choose to. It's a subtle definition. It allows minimum cardinality, but you can only express 0 or 1. Maximum cardinality of 0 or 1. Cardinality restricted 0 or 1. So we already know we could not do any HL7 data types in, or class objects, or very many in Al Lite. It would be impossible to express them. Al class axioms, it lets you say that it's one of, so it says this thing is one of that. It lets you describe these things are all different from this. So it can say that, all the months of the year are different than all the other months of the year. One cannot be the same. And so it knows how to treat those things. Can have Vibrio cholera and the different subtypes and say all of those are distinct and different and one can never be the same as the other. Same class as, which is just what it says, an RDF subclass of applied to class expressions, so that we can now say that these classes are subclasses of things as well as instances or sub-instances of other things, or parts of. This is sort of where we can start to reason a little bit about part of. You can have Boolean combinations of classes, so union of, intersection of, complement of. And now if we start looking at AL-DL full, so there's a little bit of description of AL-DL. So if we now start looking at AL full, we have all of AL-DL, all of the set unions and theories, but we also allow metaclass constructs. The problem with metaclass constructs is that there's no defining model for metaclass constructs. And because there is no defining model for metaclass constructs in AL, your inferencing engines that work with AL that depend on the language to define how the inference engines work may lead to unsatisfiable inferencing, which means the engine just goes into an infinite loop because it can't decide how to handle that, or it may lead to erroneous findings by lack of closure of a metaclass grouping. And so typically AL full, if you have to go to AL full, that's when you should start asking yourself the question of, would it be easier to express this in some other kind of a language? Now, people still use AL full, and it definitely, you're not necessarily going to do description logic in your AL full. You may not even use it in your AL-DL ontologies, because it's really only good to classify things. But what if you need to do something besides classifying? AL is monotonic. It can do one thing. Description logic can do one thing, it can classify. If your job is not classification or it extends beyond classification, then you need to use some external tool. You can still structure it in AL-DL and you can still do your classification with it, but you need to add some other engine to do some work with it, like a Java Expert System Shell or Algorithm or some other rule engine that doesn't function based on description logic. So, that screen short or something. So, we also have this arbitrary cardinality and filler information that says you can say any kind of cardinality that you want to. You're not left with 0 and 1. So now we can start to handle some of the constructs. Filler information for has value. So now we can say that a particular relationship has a particular class can have a relationship to a particular instance of something. And instances can have relationships to instances. So if we talk about, so we've got all these rules and things that we've talked about. So how do we put those rules to work in some of the editing tools, and how do you actually work with those kinds of things? And what does it take to define something? All right, so now if we want to define histidine, this amino acid histidine, what is its definition? Well, its definition is that it is a type of specific amino acid. It has some charge, which is positive. And we could have also say has value and make positive an instance and say positive is another way to do it if we had instances. This ontology doesn't have any instances. Everything is defined as a class. And it has all these other properties. So now once we've got all those things, then we can now start saying the terms that you've heard, probably necessary and sufficient. So something may have properties that are attributes, but it doesn't completely define that thing. Whereas when we start doing these definitions, we eventually can say, well, now we have some things that we can now say definitely we can classify. We can say that histidine is a aromatic amino acid, and we can say that histidine is a positively charged amino acid. And we can define that. That's defined for us. So we have enough information to define that now. And we can say that it has some inherited anonymous classes. And that's saying, well, these anonymous classes that are related to it in some mathematical set way, is that alanine also, and these also, may have some of these other properties that we've defined here that could also be defined there. So we haven't completely disambiguated some of the other properties, because there are other things that can be like this. So that's a bit of modeling an al, which, you know, if you said it looks fairly complex,
I think we have a question.
It is, yes.
I was just wondering, what is the definition of an instance? You've used that word a few times.
Yeah, so instances are the same as individuals. So I'm actually, in al, I should be saying individuals. In frames, it's called an instance. So you are an instance of the human race. Okay. There's only one of you. Even if you have a twin, there's just one of you. Okay, so you're an instance or an individual. The class, I mean, you are a part of the class of all female Homo sapiens. You're part of the class of people who work at the CDC. So. Yes?
If you're using the last two there as your defining relationships, and the rest there, when you go to inference,
yes.
Do you not pick those up? Do you define the last two only, and the other ones further just define that instance, but may or may not be part of the inference if you're matching
to. Right, so remember there aren't any instances in this ontology. So what it does, it says, if you gave me something else and I ran inferencing on it, I might, if it's got these things, I would classify it, if it's an aromatic amino acid and it's positively charged and it has these properties with it, then it is histidine. Yes, which is part of the, which is why you have to be so careful when you're doing it, because it's very easy to make it, that your inference may not be correct unless you take into account that you're, that if you have not made it defining for this, then it doesn't then it will match to anything that has that characteristic. Okay. All right, so that was ontology modeling in al. This is ontology modeling in frames, where we have slots that, because it's in the slot, I can't make any inference about this. The tool doesn't allow me to do inference, but it does allow me to hook it to an inference engine like Jess or some other rule engine that says, look for this slot, look for this, much like a database would do, except it gives you more semantics because you can do class objects and relationships to class objects. And so it's very nice for structuring things like HL7 version 3 objects with the database. So, and this is just allows you to do some translations, and you can see where you could translate V3 to V2. All right, inferencing object, reasoning objects, these are just some of the inferencing engines that are used in AL. Some of the query languages that you have some choices of, some rule engines that you can apply to either AL or frames in some cases. Swirl is for AL, obviously. But Jess or Algernon can be applied to either AL or to frames. AlQL will run across either AL or RDF. Sparkle is meant for RDF only, but can be used for AL classes as well. These are some of the ontology tools. Protégé is an open source tool. It's one that's used a lot. They have many thousands. I think they're up to about 100,000 downloads now for that. Swoop is a Java-based AL editor from the University of Maryland. Has some of the same properties. Not nearly as commonly used. OBO edit is what the gene ontology uses to do the gene ontology. It's used a lot in the OBO Foundry group, which does a lot of the biomedical ontologies. Has some limitations. It does not support multiple hierarchies, so hard to imagine how you express the real world thing, but if you believe that. Synaptica, Noodle, Top Braid Composer is a common one. We use Protégé, we use Top Braid Component, we use CMAP for our work. CMAP allows an RDF expression in addition to its concept mapping tools. And I don't know that that one is openly available, to be honest with you, for the RDF side of it. data import. So the ontology editors typically support a wide range of importing data into it, from CSV files, from Excel, databases, XML files, UML in the form of XMI to bring into it. So so you can have your data in pretty much anything and still use semantic tools. Comma separated values are for data export. We can take from AL to RDF. We can export in AL. We can export in XML. We can export from frames to RDF or to AL. And we can bring export to XMI to build UML models from it. So data extraction, we're going to talk about a little bit more, Craig is. And I'm going to stop there.
I'm going to ask questions for questions.
Do we want to hold the questions till the end? Because they may have some more after your...
That could be. But is there anything that is pertinent for right now that you would like to ask Cecil?
One of the things to let you know, event today was a little bit of a surprise to us. So we actually have a workshop on Thursday. And we were walking down the hall yesterday and saw that there was an ontology workshop being given today. And that we were surprised that there was another group giving an ontology presentation. And so much of what we've done today will be covered on Thursday, but think about that we're going from a four and a half hour session on Thursday down to about an hour and a half today. So we've had to pare down and skip over a few things. And so if there's something you've missed, then just realize that we're going to go into much more detail on Thursday. Yes, ma'am. Okay, I'm going to give the non-CDC answer, because I don't care who shows up.
I think you're supposed to, but maybe you should ask the right question.
And I won't kick anybody out, right? So it's not. All right, so let's get through this real quick. Basically, you saw where Cecil was coming from, and basically a lot of this talk is more, how do we use ontologies, right? Cecil's now given us a great example of how building them up and the domain knowledge that goes into building them, both from the concept maps and the mind maps and the way content is related into there. But from our perspective, as you build these ontologies, you build them maybe for generalized purpose, but in order to represent the deep understanding of a particular domain. And if we're going to use an example of public health, and in particular taking and building up from vocabulary elements, so our representation of common standards in the way we communicate data or represent data from clinical findings to laboratory tests and those things, and build that up through the data types and observation classes, we represent that in an overall structure of an information model or a clinical health model, and then how does public health interface with that model? So it's kind of the foundations of where we would build to if we were going to use the techniques and technologies that Cecil has described. Eventually, we come into this reference ontology, which says here is a common representation of public health within the notion of clinical condition, a public health case or condition. Now, based on that, we have this very generalized tool with this representations and all these associations of data, the attributes, and the way they interact together. But now, what are we going to do with that? So that's kind of what we're going to talk about today. And in particular, we have this very large model that takes on public health in a very generalized sense, but we're going to want to use that in a very lightweight way. So we might want to build an application to service a TB application. So we don't need all of public health understanding, we just need the things that are important to the TB. So we might want to extract that out to use that as a foundation for that particular application. The other point here is that when you're taking ontologies, you can merge them together without having to go through the engineering of having to put them into one source. And so once we do an extraction, we might have a public health case ontology for TB. But the other thing we might do is a drug interaction ontology for just representing the way drugs interact, or maybe adverse effects between drug interactions. And so what we might want to do is look at TB as a case, and then look at the particular aspects of the way we represent drugs that are given to TB patients and the interactions of those drugs to look for, you know, from a clinical perspective, look for problems. So those are the kinds of things we might do. So we look at the knowledge as representation from this ontology that we want to represent, and we use that in different and unique ways based on the needs of our application. So we might represent that in a way from a user interface of looking at it as just flat file of value sets that we use to upload into the pull-down menus of an application. We might load those into a database or a FIN database or into the VADS database as sets of attributes of constrained value sets. That's another way to look at it. But we may want to actually integrate this into our application and actually begin to use and to be able to populate data as we're doing surveillance collection or syndromic surveillance or something like that. So we might want to take that and generate that into a set of objects that we use within an application. We may just provide a service interface through, you know, web services or through, you know, a typical SOAP interface to actually allow you to go down and use the query language or other interface engines to get, or interface capabilities to get down into the ontology. Or we might actually have to do a custom extraction for a particular application of actually going down and pulling out the pieces of data that we might need. So that's kind of what we're going to talk about. So if you think about it from the service layer down, if we're looking at a representation of an ontology, we might start at the very base level of looking at our CHI standard code sets, the values of information that are represented within public health from a national standards perspective. But those code systems are not represented in a common representation as we get them from their SDOs. Some of them are hierarchical, some of them are not hierarchical. But if we're going to build them into a model, we need a semantic relationship that is consistent across those. And so the first step is to kind of go from the SDOs up into that semantic relationship and then provide those as individual services. Now, that still doesn't give us our public health domain model, right? So the next step is to then pull it into the clinically defined public health reference ontology, and so make those mappings by reference from those standard value sets. So now you have the representation of the content in those semantic systems and then pull it into the ontologies. Now from the reference ontology, we may want to build a specific application for syphilis or for TB or something like that, or we might look at doing something of a case detection, case reporting criteria, something like that. So extracting the pieces of the ontology out that we need, we might put that into a vocabulary or into another set of domain ontologies, or we might pull into other existing community ontologies and tie those together at that specific extraction layer, and then we might provide a set of services on top of that, common services like CTS for the common terminology services. We might build some common query services that go down into that base representation, or we might actually build some application modules like we've done with a message classification that can be used in a generalized service through a web interface. So those are the kind of the ways that this happens. Oops, wrong way. Now, if you look at the public health domain model, health domain model, it's very complex. And what I'm talking about is then being able to extract components out of that overall model to use for a particular application. This is the yellow highlighted, and I'm not really expecting you to read that, is really the representation of the data we need for bioterrorism and to identify and track syndromic surveillance from a syndromic surveillance perspective. Keep going the wrong way. Now, if we look at a class representation or the actual public health domain model that we're interested in for case detection, we look at a public health disorder has radiology observations that are associated with it, investigated agents, incubation periods, lab observations, occupational risk, vaccines, therapeutical medications, and condition observations and procedures that might be performed. Now, if you think about that, that's the content that we're going to be getting from our private health care to be reported into the overall public health infrastructure. And we might use something from this for message communication. Oops. Now, based on that, we have a UML model that then can actually generate the ontological representation for that. You can then also generate source code for your Java objects, or you can identify the attributes that you're going to pull out from your OWL reasoning from an OWL description. Now, if you take that domain knowledge that we extract out, and we get down to that specialization, we provide the service layer. The only thing necessary now that we've represented that complex data in the domain ontology. You allow that to be accessed through an application layer using design patterns that are common, not having to take into consideration the detailed domain knowledge of the underlying piece. And then you model business application. We're going to show you some just simple models of how to tie together that domain knowledge with the specifics that you're trying to execute within your business layer. keep going the wrong way. So let's ask ourselves the question, when we're going to go build a surveillance system, we might ask a simple question, what are reportable conditions within a jurisdiction that I'm going to build the system for? Now, how much engineering does it take from a requirements analysis and design going through that whole process to actually answer that question and to build the data around that? You can think of that taking weeks, months, just to do that analysis. But now, if you've got that represented within your common representation of the domain model, the only thing I'm looking at is doing a query off of that ontology to pull up reportable conditions within that thing. Now, I've got a model for those reportable conditions. So one of the questions I might ask myself in my application is, what are the lab tests that are used to confirm that condition? Right? Now, if you're thinking about a software engineer doing the requirements analysis and then design of a system and going through that, that is a lot of work. And if I do that for every system that requires lab results to be used in the confirmation of a case, think about the engineering effort that goes into that process for every system that we build. Instead of that, if we're just drawing that from the ontology, we don't have to go through that domain knowledge understanding as software engineers to build systems. We simply interface to the part that says, given a condition, give me the lab tests that are there. Or flip that question around saying, given this lab test, what condition does this support? Or does it refute? We can look at what are positive tests, what are negative tests, what other conditions might this lab test be associated with, what are the clinical findings. We can represent in that domain ontology the issues of what percentage of cases present with this particular finding. We can look at what other conditions are, so you can do differential diagnosis. Now we're doing that on a simple query into the ontological representation versus having to build all of that knowledge into our systems from the start. Now, if you think about that, you take one instance of this representation and now you eliminate the requirements at the level of detail that would go through for a software engineer and an informaticist to kind of put all that together for a particular application. So the idea is we can cut down the amount of work and the consistency of our applications and the work by representing data this way. Let's see, anything else there? One of the questions we might ask are what drugs are used to treat this, and then what adverse interactions might have with other drugs that a patient might have. Now the question is, do we have to build that ontology? No, those ontologies exist by the FDA, and we tie those in, and now all of a sudden we've got a report coming to us that says, here we have a patient being treated with this drug and other drugs, and very simply we can communicate or to look at that other ontology and say, are there any drug interaction problems? Now think about all the engineering that would have to go into that to be able to answer that question if I was going to build a system to do just adverse drug event reporting. Okay, now not only did I just describe that domain logic, but then if you have to think about an engineer going down and understanding all of the specific coding standards that are necessary to use in a federally compliant system today and building all that out, now I've got to go down and as an engineer, I've got to understand SNOMED and LOINC, the interactions between SNOMED and LOINC, the interactions of local coding systems that might map into that. Again, you start to think about the level of detail that you have to engineer every time we go out and build a system. It's no wonder we spend $20 million to build a surveillance system of any type. And we do that from one disease to the next disease. What happens when SARS comes out? Well, we have to go build that all over again. Instead of representing it in that domain model and in the knowledge and in understanding underneath that. And so the idea is that you build it in one place and you allow it to be deployed over and over again. And when we find something new or a new understanding, or we need a new component to that model, we add that in at that one level, and then it's reusable. You can use governance on the top of that to say that some things are going to be just application specific and leave those ontologies at that application layer and not bring them back into the core model. And other times you might want to add and extend those core ontologies. Let's see, is there anything else I need to say here? Oh, backwards again. GB, would you just slap me every time I do that?
Question.
Yes, sir.
If it's time to go. Several years ago, there's a lot of work being done. Premature,
so we're talking about the from the, well, that's.
So it's very, so, well, very enough. The model that was built around Ned's original was V3 like.
but it was B3 life based on the rim. This ontology is B3 compliant completely and based on the case notification message. So one is an abstract.
I'm not going to do that.
This is a concrete model that's used in messaging, so it reflects actually the data that we sent.
They were starting from abstract, trying to move towards concrete. They're kind of moving roughly there.
Yeah, before their time. So yeah. Now, I mean, I think we have much better. One, the rim has changed a lot, so it's constrained down the set of abstract classes and the special classes. At their point, they had a bunch of abstract classes that had tried to be concrete more quiet, so it was destined to fail.
Okay, so if you think about a couple another, two new dimensions or additional dimensions. So we've got the data, and going from localized data to this common federally standardized data set. And then also in the communication of being able to take and bring data in from these standard messages, HL7 message structures, and then map them back into HL7 message. So the domain model and analysis from that, from the ontological representation, allows you to do those things in that localized service without having to rebuild that each time that you want to do it. See, again. Yeah, that's fine. Semantic code representations, we've already talked about that. Up or down, GB? Down, okay. Reference ontology. Okay, so basically from our perspective, the reference ontology talks about case definitions, case reporting criteria, case status criteria. So being able to define, now this isn't feasible at this point in a standardized way from the CDC CSTV's perspective. One of the contracts that we are underway with is to actually look at CSTE case position or condition position statements and to begin to add the informatics into those representations. The next layer after that information layer is identified and vetted through the community of both the, from a CSTE perspective and CDC perspective, so there we've got contributors on both sides, bringing that together, representing the informatics. The next step is then to be able to define the constraints around what is reportable, what are reporting criteria, and what are the case status definitions. So those will evolve out over a period of time. And this isn't something that happens easy, because as you have committees of people of have insight and information, you have to build up through these things. But the idea is the foundations are there to begin building towards automated case detection or reporting detection through those standardized position statements. And so the goal over a period of the next couple of years is to take this base informatics piece and then start adding the constraints of saying what is reportable, when should it be reportable, when should it be detected, and doing that off of message structures and things like that. So that's the direction. Okay, so next layer is the extraction. So we have common extractions that are necessary today, and we pull out of the ontologies facts that represent into reasoning structures to be able to do pattern matching, and I'm going to show you an example of that in just a few minutes. But also Java classes, if you saw the UML, we can generate the UML classes and then export the data right out of the ontological representation into something that's executable, and I'll show you an example, at least a window of that. Long way. Okay. So now, this is a simple screen. If think about from a computer science perspective, what it takes to build this window is a couple of lines of code, right? Not from the content, but from the structure of the window. I have simply the notion of a national notifiable disease, and I have the representation of anthrax selected here in a tree structure of what the content for that ontological representation is. So I have transmission modes, airborne, incubation periods, clinical findings. We have all the way down through lab tests and radiology tests and risk factors, those things. And then if I click on one of those attributes, I look at a citation of where that is represented, where we drew that into the public health reference ontology. So now all of this information exists, and if you built an application and did a query on anthrax, to get those features back, it automatically populates your UI. So I've taken in about 2 hours worth of work, I would say, used a simple Java interface to the ontological representation, and I've built a complete information scheme for all of my clinically defined notifiable diseases. So how long would that take if I started from scratch, had an engineer go through, derive all this information, use my, you know, BAs to collect the data, use Sundac to define my value sets for this? And you think about the engineering time it takes for that versus what it takes to interface to that application. I mean, we're talking minutes versus weeks. And if it's vetted through the community, which is even more important, it becomes now something that we standardize on across our applications as we go to do development and our domain representations there. Now, one other point I want to make here is that if I received a piece of data in, I'm trying to match on anthrax, and I get a piece of information that is headache, but my definition, well, let's see, I have, let's say, aching pain of the head, and that's the data that comes in from my message, I can map into the hierarchy that suggests that it matches to headache. And I can represent that as a match, whereas I would have had to think about that whole hierarchy, hierarchical representation if I'd been building that from scratch.
Can you go over that again?
Sure.
Exactly what you mean by suggestive?
Okay, so in the case definition, we have headache, which is a particular observation. And if a local hospital is reporting it, but reports it at a different level within a hierarchy, so
essentially what it says is that it doesn't, we use the SNOMED hierarchy, and we actually use both SNOMED hierarchy and the BioSense terms, which contain misspelling, Spanish representation, and other things, ICD-9 terms, and they're mapped together to this representation of headache, which is in the case definition. The case definition that somebody's going to look at says headache is a finding with this particular condition. But the message may not be headache. It may be some variation or misspelling or something else. So this just allows you to say, take in some language variation of it and map it to that case, to that headache.
But you're not using the entire hierarchy. You're subsetting it in some way. There are a lot of criticisms of the hierarchy that you've got there. There are a lot of things that are specializations of headache but are not relevant to headache in the context of anthrax. And so,
well, yeah. It uses the context within what is defined in the, so SNOMED is subsetted in the ontology down to the level of practice. So we don't use the upper level hierarchies in general. We've already constrained down to things that, as you say, can't be relationships.
Let's get through it. We want to come back to that.
In the ontology, we'll pop it.
Now, just talking very quickly about a application design level that allows us to do specific or generalized reasoning without any dependence on public health. So basically, we have the ability to plug in data coming in or data sources coming into a system. So you might parse HL7.2.5, HL7.2.5TB, you know, any other message structure, V3 message, 2.x message. That comes in and represents that data semantically in those RDF triples. And so the data that's parsed out of the thing is built into that from the source data coming in. This registry then allows a different set of implementations of reasoners. Let's say we have a case message classification reasoner, we have a differential diagnosis reasoner, we have an alert generation reasoner for things comes up. The issues would be that the business logic would be represented in very generic terms, and I'm going to show you an example of one of those terms, but it is independent of that source knowledge. Source knowledge is understood in the way it's represented within HL7 within the observation sets, but it is independent of having to know anything about the domain. On the other side, facts are generated out of the ontological representation, which then allows us to give a definition, like you saw in the outline of anthrax, of what lab tests are associated with that, what treatments are associated with that, and so on and so forth. So there's the public health knowledge base and the source data coming in, and all we have to do to actually combine those together to solve different problems is build rule patterns that are actually can be reasoned there. Now the idea is that this implementation is used in many different disciplines. It can be used in defense-oriented things. It can be used in public health. It doesn't have to know anything about public health. The only thing that is public health related are when I build the input registry for the sources and the business logic that we build in here. Everything else is domain independent. Then we bring from the ontology up the knowledge base that then populates it, gives us the deep understanding. Yeah, yeah, and it parses the message in a way that then represents that in a standardized triple. Okay. For specific definition, we have a case classification or message classification piece, which brings in a 2.5 HL7 source. It's parsed in. That fact generator brings those triples into say, and it publishes it onto this knowledge space. We have three different reasoners that are just simple implementations. One is a classification saying, what does this message, what conditions could this message represent if it doesn't know a priori? So it might have ADT messages for emergency room admittance records. It might be, so there's a variety of messages that might come in and be processed. It correlates any information when we have patient identifiers that can be correlated together. So another one says, if I see a patient on the registry and I get another message in and it publishes something about the classification of that patient, I can then combine those two things together and get a better representation of that. And then the last one is alert generation. If it meets a certain criteria for a case, then it can generate an alert off of that. So they're very generic rules that I put on, and just to give you an example of how that works.
Yeah. Different reference ontologies performance in detection.
Yes.
So you can plug another, plug any other ontology.
There is a simple API to this registry, so you can plug in, and it doesn't have, we use Jess principally because it fits and operates within the parameters that we need to operate in, but any representation can be plugged in there. All it needs to do is know how to communicate and consume RDF triples. So that's API is very simple that way. And at the same time, we do an extraction of our public health ontology to the specific knowledge bases that are required here. So what condition, what does this message indicate? Does it contain enough information to notify somebody about this condition? So is it notifiable? Does it have enough no? What data might I need to complete that notification? What question do I have to ask? Are there any counterindicators that say this isn't this condition? Negative lab test or, I have A identification versus C. What drugs are being used? Is it being used in a typical way? We've done something with TB, at least looking at drug interaction, identifying drug resistant strains, so MDR for single, XDR for multiple. And the issue is if we have an XDR or a non-resistant case and somebody's using a level 3 drug, then is that a protocol violation or something we should alert the doctor on that's using the wrong set of drugs, right? They should be using level 1 drugs. Are there other patients with this common reference set of conditions that map, that look like they're similar? So those kinds of questions can be generally represented within the rule structure. Now, let me show you just a generic rule pattern. This matches condition observations based on the incoming message with the triples that we identify. So clinical finding for condition based on coded values. So that takes all of the data and matches against the definition. So if we come in with an observation from a message, which would be this observation here, it would match all conditions that have that value as a clinical finding, and it would do the correlation between them in the hierarchies. And then we would look at that condition code and say, does it meet reporting criteria? Is it a member of the reporting criteria for this? And if so, publish that evidence. So if you think about this, we don't know anything about the condition in the rule we just wrote. We only know that a condition has clinical findings that are represented, and that we allow the ontology to represent the rest of that detailed domain knowledge to be able to finalize the answer. So basically here, we're collecting endorsements or evidence that this condition is present. The next thing I I was going to write a rule that was in more detail, but this takes two or three rules to actually work out, so I did it in more logic. So one of the things I might do for reporting criteria, it says if I have two clinical findings, observations, that meet the reporting criteria, and one test ordered, not necessarily the test that results, but the order that says it would confirm that particular condition, then I report the condition within that timeline. So that's a reporting criteria case. It's that simple. I mean, you could imagine how we would write that in a couple of rules to do the membership collection of all the evidence that we found. Does it meet this rule? If so, report it. And at the same time, we could write a second rule that says one clinical finding plus a risk factor and that, report it. So the idea is that I can write three rules to do reporting criteria based on a message stream. You can believe that last night when we found out we had to do this and I wrote this rule, it didn't take me very long to do that, right? So the idea is that we can continue to build out those kind of functional capabilities and continue to extend that rule base. And if I get a new set of clinical findings or a new set of lab tests that are defined this year, we simply add those to the construct of the ontology, and we don't have to go back and change any code. So this becomes a much more flexible way to evolve our systems and solutions. And you can see that we can put sets of rules together to do very small, very specific sets of problems, solve those problems, and then go on to the next problem and communicate this. And if we plug these in through standard APIs for reference, you know, for within the service-oriented architecture, you plug that into the DMB, which we did for TB for the case of the message validation. And basically that, you write your rules, you plug it into the right ontology, and it works. And so as we go on.
I think we should,
we've got 5 minutes left. Yeah, so I think that'll be the end. And let's see if there's anything. Yeah, I'm gonna go through, there's some references here. So I guess, is there any questions? Now, we're sorry we had to spin through this so fast. Obviously, there's a lot more detail. So what Cecil did is go through and delete every other slide or every two slides or something like that. So
is there, you're talking about the public health reference ontology.
Right.
Does that entity exist?
Well, there are foundations that are beginning to start to put that together.
So do you want to plug?
Yeah, please do.
I just want to give you the editorial comment on that. It's definitely getting worked on right now. It's in progress. We're looking at some. Why don't you stand here? There's probably some other questions for you.
Oh, I can.
Oh, yeah. We're actively working through that activity. So we're going to open it up to the broad community in an open format quite soon, to get us towards a reference ontology in the public health domain. Which group is we? Great question. One of the communities of practice that will be started, probably not at this conference, but between this conference and the next conference, is going to be a community of practice tailored towards the public health ontology. And you are welcome to join. And on the Finn website, there will be a position to show when we'll be starting that.